John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for 4th September to 10th, 2010. As Palestinians and Israelis start direct peace talks, Palestinians demand settlement freeze in order to continue with the talks, and the settlers set up assaults against Palestinian civilians. These stories and more coming up, stay tuned. Let us begin our weekly report, as usual, with the nonviolent activities in the West Bank. This week, villagers from Al-Walaja, Southern West Bank, and Bala'in, Central West Bank, organized their weekly anti-wall protests. In other villages who organize weekly nonviolent protests, the villagers decided to visit their relatives on the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr to promote integrity and to support each other instead of the direct action for this week. In the West Bank village of Al-Walaja near Bethlehem, hundreds of the villagers gathered near the construction site of the wall and held the holiday prayer in the early hours of Friday morning to protest the confiscation of their land by the Israeli authorities and the construction of the wall. During the activities, the sheikh of the village spoke to the crowd about the need to continue with the nonviolent demonstrations and to resist the wall until it is removed. The Israeli military was present, however, they did not interrupt the protest. Elsewhere, dozens of Palestinians, along with international and Israeli supporters, marched in the village of Bala'in after Friday's noon prayer to protest the construction of the annexation wall on their lands. As protesters arrived near the gate of the wall, Israeli troops fired a number of tear gas canisters at them, causing a number of protesters to choke. The wounded were treated by field medics. Staying in Bala'in, the Spanish Parliament followed the footsteps of the EU and the Desmond Tutu of the Elders and joined the rising tide of international criticism over Abu Rahma's conviction of incitement by an Israeli military court. Abu Rahma, the coordinator of the Bala'in Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements, was sentenced to 2 years in jail time. He was arrested by the military on December of 2009. Abu Rahma activist was acquitted of 2 out of 4 charges brought against him in the indictment, stone throwing and a ridiculous and vindictive arms possession charge. The court did, however, find Abu Rahma guilty of two of the most draconian anti-free speech articles in military legislation, incitement and organizing and participating in illegal demonstrations. It did so based only on testimonies of minors who were arrested in the middle of the night and denied their right to legal counsel, and despite acknowledging significant ills in their questioning. Commenting on the Israeli court verdict, Human Rights Watch said that this raises grave due process concerns. As Israelis and Palestinians start direct peace talks, Palestinians complain of Israel's ongoing settlement activities in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Israeli leaders insist that Israel has the right to build settlements, an issue that might end the direct peace talks on the end of September. The details with IMEMC's George Rishmawi.
The end of September might be the end of peace talks if Israel refuses to extend the settlement freeze, the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said earlier this week. President Abbas was quoted as saying, quote, "This was made clear to President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton and to the Israeli Prime Minister, and I told him, you have to know that if you don't continue with the settlement freeze, we will leave these negotiations," end quote. In the meantime, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his Minister of Defense Ehud Barak clearly indicated that Israel will not renew the settlement freeze. On his part, Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman vowed to act against any decision to freeze settlement activities on the occupied Palestinian territories, including occupied East Jerusalem. In an interview with the Israeli radio, Lieberman said that his party, Israel Beitanu, in English, Israel Our Home, has enough power in the government to prevent any decision against settlement activities. On the other hand, local observers maintain that despite Israel's declaration of a settlement freeze, there was no real freeze. During the claimed 10-month freeze, Israeli settlements watchdog Peace Now reported 492 violations of the freeze. Based in part on aerial photographs, the group said construction had begun on at least 600 housing units in 60 different settlements. Palestinian legislator Dr. Mustafa Barghouti stated that while Israel is heading to peace talks with the Palestinians, its government continues its illegal settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem. The Palestinian president has also made some critical statements regarding the borders of the future Palestinian state. He said that he informed the Israeli and American diplomats that the border issue is more important than security issue. He added that his approach to borders would begin with the 1967 lines and demarcating a Palestinian state from there. Quote, "Once we have the borders set, we can find a solution for Jerusalem, the water issue, and the settlements," end quote. He said and added that the issue of refugees would be tackled in the next round, warning that he is willing to resign if asked to give up the rights of Palestinian refugees. In the meantime, tension between the two major Palestinian parties was heightened after the Palestinian Authority security forces arrested around 750 Hamas members and affiliates in the West Bank. Hamas issued a statement warning the Palestinian Authority of continuing these arrests and called upon its members and supporters in the West Bank to resist the arrest. The arrest campaign came shortly after Hamas claimed responsibility for the deadly attack against Israeli settlers last week, which claimed the lives of four Israeli settlers, and another attack in which two settlers were wounded. For IMEMC.org, this is George Rishmawi.
Israeli military forces conducted 47 incursions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank and abducted 23 Palestinian civilians, including a child, in the West Bank, and launched airstrikes against a number of targets in the Gaza Strip, killing two and wounding others. With IMEMC's Kathy Winter has more.
On Thursday night, the Israeli Air Force carried out five airstrikes targeting a number of areas in different parts of the Gaza Strip, inflicting damage and a number of injuries. A Palestinian medical source reported that a number of Palestinian security officers suffered mild injuries due to the shelling, which targeted a security facility west of Gaza City. In Rafah, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, the Israeli Air Force conducted three airstrikes targeting tunnels along the borders with Egypt. Excessive damage was reported, but no injuries. Furthermore, the Israeli warships fired three missiles at two tunnels near the Salah ed-Din gate in the southern Gaza Strip and on a local livestock market in Gaza City, causing serious damage to the property, but no injuries. The Israeli attack also included a site claimed to be the training grounds for the Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of the Hamas. The army said that the attack came after Palestinian fighters fired shells and a mortar into southern Israel. On Saturday, 4th of September, two Palestinians were killed and three others were injured in an Israeli airstrike on the southern part of the coastal enclave. In the West Bank, an Israeli settler opened fire on Tuesday as Palestinian cars driving near the northern city of Nablus. According to a Palestinian driver, the settler created a roadblock and opened fire at him as he drove near him at the entrance of Kedumim settlement. The driver said that he did not stop to question the settler, but kept on driving as he was driving a patient to the hospital, adding that he saw the settler stopping other Palestinian cars on the road. On Thursday, many armed Israeli settlers coming from Halmish settlement, northwest of Ramallah, closed the main road in front of the settlement. They terrified and provoked Palestinian civilians traveling on the road. Israeli forces intervened later and moved the settlers away from the road. Later, on the same day, Israeli settlers from Shiloh, a settlement north of Ramallah, threw stones at a Palestinian civilian vehicle that was traveling on Ramallah-Nablus Road. As a result, the front window was broken. On Saturday, a number of Israeli settlers gathered at Homesh intersection northwest of Nablus. They threw stones at Palestinian civilian vehicles traveling on Nablus Road. Also, this week, Israeli forces transformed three Palestinian houses into military sites in Hebron. For IMEMC.org, this is Kathy Winter.
And that was just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupy in Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Sam Qassis and Dina Awad.
In early September, Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas came to Washington to begin direct peace talks at the behest of President Obama. The Middle East leaders were accompanied by the presidents of Jordan and Egypt to demonstrate regional support for this new effort at negotiations. Netanyahu and Abbas declared their first meeting a positive step and plan to meet every 2 weeks for a year, with the goal of finalizing a settlement to a conflict that's gone on even longer than the 62 years Israel has officially existed. The leaders have pledged to take up the thorniest so-called permanent status issues sooner rather than later. They include establishing borders, Jerusalem as a shared capital, the future of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes, and the equitable sharing of scarce water resources. These issues have often been key elements in scuttling previous attempts at brokering a peace agreement. Abbas is negotiating on behalf of Fatah, the largest party within the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which governs the West Bank, while Hamas, that controls Gaza, is not included in the negotiations. The talks are being brokered by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and former Senator George Mitchell, U.S. Special Middle East Peace Envoy. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Hussein Ibish, senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine, who assesses this latest round of Middle East peace talks and the obstacles that stand in the way of reaching an agreement.
Neither of the parties was particularly keen, it would appear, to enter into these negotiations. But the Obama administration was insisting, and really I think the reality of them is a kind of testament to American influence and the determination of the administration. They really weren't willing to take no for an answer. They started in on this issue on the very first day of Obama's, after he was inaugurated. The talks themselves are something of an accomplishment for the administration. It's not substantive, of course, it doesn't change anything, but it wasn't easy. Another thing is that you've got, for the first time in a long time, publicly, Israeli and Palestinian leaders coming forward and saying they want to talk, they are talking, and they want to do a deal, and they think a deal can be done. Now, you know, of course, it would be perfectly reasonable to speculate that they're just saying that. But on the other hand, is they both have to be tested, and there isn't any way to test them outside the context of direct negotiation. The third thing that I think is a little different is that you know, the kind of starkness of the alternative is clearer now than it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago. I think, I think it's really very clear where the conflict is going without a movement towards an agreement. I think you can see it both in Israeli society and in Palestinian society, the shift towards the religious right and the kind of slow drift of the conflict away from an ethnic one over land and power, basically a political conflict, into one that's much more based on religion and the will of God in holy places that really will be much more difficult to resolve in any way.
Hussein Ibish, what about the role of Hamas? You know, George Mitchell, who mediated the settlement in Northern Ireland and is trying to reach the peace deal between Israel and Palestine, famously said the way they reached agreement in Northern Ireland was by bringing all the parties to the table, even those who were accused with good reason of being terrorists. Now somebody asked point blank, what's the role of Hamas? And he said none. And in fact, it looks like they have none. So how can there be a solution?
Hamas has no role. That's perfectly clear. None of the three parties involved in the negotiations, Israel, the PLO, and the United States, wants them there. And Hamas doesn't accept the basic framework of the talks either. So it's not clear at all that Hamas wants to be there. I don't see any evidence that they do. You know, if you begin with the premise that you'll never recognize Israel under any circumstances, it becomes very hard for you to be part of the negotiations for a Palestinian state alongside of Israel. It's just, you ruled out the end game already. However, of course, it's very true that Hamas is an important political player and represents an important constituency. So at a certain point, when you start to get closer to an agreement and really looks like you're going to have one, and you have to think in terms of, as a practical matter, having one, and what do you do about Hamas's constituency, Hamas itself, and the area they rule in Gaza, and how do you deal with that? And there are many, many, many ways of dealing with it, especially because I think it's going to be politically extremely difficult for Hamas if that happens. I think almost impossible. And the organization is going to be faced with some incredibly difficult choices. But it's at that point that you really have to start looking for practical solutions to the problem. At the moment, you've got the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which is, by every document, the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. They are authorized to negotiate with Israel on national matters. There's a practical reality that there's another Palestinian party that has to be taken into consideration. The ability of Hamas to reach beyond the core constituency that actually believes in their very conservative, religious, fundamentalist politics, which is probably about 15 or 17% of Palestinians, but their ability to reach beyond that to bigger constituencies is predicated on a lack of hope for peace and circumstances of despair that make their message of, or at least the rhetoric of armed struggle, appealing to a bigger number of Palestinians. You know, insofar as people really are very cynical about the possibility of peace, Hamas's approach looks good. But as you get closer and closer to a reality in which, you know, if it does happen, where the PLO strategy of the negotiations seems to be about to produce a result, or is leading, you know, almost inexorably to a result of independence, it's going to be very hard for Hamas. And I think they're going to end up splitting along several axes. I don't know if the group will break up, but it'll certainly be incredible divisions between those who are more oriented towards Palestinian nationalism and would want to be involved in the new Palestinian state and vying for power and participating in all of that, and those who are more oriented regionally to the Muslim Brotherhood movement in the entire Arab world or to allies in Iran and Syria.
That was Hussein Ibish of the American Task Force on Palestine. Contact the task force by calling area code 202-887-0177 or visit their website at americantaskforce.org.
Afghanistan today. One civilian may have been killed and 6 others were injured in a protest in northern Afghanistan's Badakhshan province against plans to burn the Quran in the U.S. Afghan authorities dispute the reported death, while local residents report that NATO occupation troops opened fire on the crowd. Across Afghanistan, thousands protested today against plans by U.S. fundamentalist pastors to burn the Quran on September 11th. Pakistan today. Hundreds of people, some burning U.S. flags in the central city of Multan, demonstrated against threats to burn the Quran. Florida, last night, nutjob fundamentalist Christian Reverend Terry Jones announced he was suspending plans to burn the Quran, but it's too late as copycat plans are spreading across the country. Springfield, Tennessee, today, Reverend Bob Old has vowed to burn 3 copies of the Quran in his backyard and upload the video to YouTube. New York City, today, Imam Fazl Abdul Rauf in New York said he has not even spoken to and will not meet with Jones, quote, nor are we going to barter for what some are regarding as the Quran held hostage to fundamentalist Christian terror. Here's what President Barack Obama had to say about anybody burning the Quran on September 11th.
Here's a way of endangering our troops, our sons and daughters.
This will be at least as big as the Danish cartoons, maybe even as big as those famous torture photos that came out of Abu Ghraib in Iraq. Can you say Fallujah? While we are on the subject of President Barack Obama's speeches, so much for all that bullshit about combat operations in Iraq being over. Like I said, that's been said before with similar results. Diyala Province, Iraq, today, two people were beheaded in two separate incidents. Four men raided the home of a policeman in a village northwest of Bakuba and beheaded his wife when they failed to find him. Gunmen beheaded Sunni cleric Jabbar Salah al-Jabouri at his house in a village near Muqtadiya. All U.S. war objectives in Iraq were defeated except for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Exxon and BP are not allowed to own Iraqi oil fields. The radical free trade and privatization experiment proposed by Paul Wolfowitz died under fire in summer 2003 as fired Sunni workers joined insurgent groups. Al-Qaeda in Iraq did not exist before the war, and unlike U.S. combat troops, is not even pretending to leave Iraq. Muqtada al-Sadr is unarrested and his Mahdi army is unbeaten and unbowed. Lastly, Mr. President, there is no stable government in Iraq 5 months after a Florida 2000-style election. Mr. Barack Obama, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Now is the time to throw in the towel and bring all the troops home from both wars today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
Protests at the homes of corporate criminals aren't just for those who torture animals anymore. On the 22nd of August, members of Code Pink showed up at the home of Blackwater's founder, Eric Prince. They were there to demand that he stay in the U.S. to face criminal charges for the infamous Nisour Square shootings, where his men murdered 17 innocent civilians in Baghdad back in 2007. The protest began with the delivery of a letter to the home, which was thought to be empty due to rumors that Eric Prince had fled to the United Arab Emirates.
All right, so here I'm going to put this up on Eric Prince's door, and this is a letter from the new company called Pinkwater. Dear Eric Prince, on behalf of U.S. taxpayers, we say shame on you. Through your company Blackwater, or Z, as you now like to call it, stole hundreds of millions of dollars. Your employees also killed innocent civilians in Iraq, and you should be held responsible. Don't run away to the Emirates to escape prosecution. Stay here in the USA and face the consequences of your actions like a good Christian.
That would be, yeah.
Sincerely, Pinkwater.
Ms. Pinkwater.
It turned out that at least Eric Prince's family was still there. At first, they invited Medea Benjamin into the house, only to turn around and demand that she leave, physically assault her, and then charge her with trespassing and have her arrested after being invited into the home when Miss Prince realized this was about Blackwater's crimes. Here's what it sounded like when Miss Prince decided to physically push Medea Benjamin out the door as she was attempting to leave under her own power.
I'm getting pushed out here.
Whoa.
So Eric Prince's family is actually here. They haven't left for the Emirates. They are all inside. We sat there and waited for the police to come because she said she'd called the police. And I just wanted to make sure that the police knew that we didn't trespass. we were asked to leave and left. And instead, she had me arrested.
Homeowners told her to come out and talk to you.
Well, they still have called us. It may not be the homeowners, but the people at the house have called us and told us that we have to come up here and make sure you guys get out.
Well, she said get out of
need your IDs.
She said get out of our house.
Yeah.
So
it's okay.
She never said get off the property, though.
Your ID in the car, if you find it for me real quick, please.
So I was released from jail after 5 hours. This is the complaint that was filed by Joanna Prince, the wife of Eric Prince, and it accuses me of trespassing or remaining on the property of Joanna Prince after having been forbidden to do so by an authorized individual. I had to put up $500 for a bond.
Remember, Blackwater's founder, Eric Prince, is looking at facing criminal charges for allowing his mercenaries to shoot down 17 men, women, and children at Nisour Square, the youngest being 9-year-old Ali Kanani. Yet he and his wife have the nerve to charge someone with trespassing after being invited into their home. It's Eric Prince who should be posting bail, or maybe not, since he's clearly a flight risk. Medea Benjamin of Code Pink was arrested for trespassing in a place in which she had been invited, unlike U.S. troops or mercenaries in Iraq. Hey, Eric Prince, you stinking water buffalo turd. Remember, in D.C., in the United States, and in Iraq, there's no sleep for the wicked. Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
For the past 64 years, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia has been graduating assassins, dictators, and death squad leaders to do the dirty work of the elite in Latin America. The taxpayer-funded SOA has left a trail of violence and suffering in every country where its graduates have returned. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, displaced, and massacred by those trained at the SOA. Enough is enough. Every year, thousands gather in Georgia to protest U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Join us at the gates of the SOA this November to honor the victims, celebrate the resistance, and pressure our government to shut down the school once and for all. From November 18th to 21st, we will have live concerts, speakers from around the world, street theater, workshops, and more. For more information on how you can stand with us to end the injustice, visit SOAW.org or call 202-234-3440.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
On Labor Day, a showdown at an early voting place left one person punched by a Fannie supporter and nearly erupted into general fighting
after Fannie's supporters had the nerve to show up in Northeast. At the Turkey Thicket Recreation Center in Northeast, Mayor Fannie had the nerve to show up with supporters for speeches. This amounts to having a campaign rally at a voting place, an illegal practice in many places. Though I don't know if this is true in D.C. Here's what WTOP Radio reported as it happened. Quote, Mayor Adrian Fannie was speaking to supporters when a few very vocal supporters of challenger Vince Gray tried to interrupt. One woman confronted Fannie after being laid off from her D.C. government job. Another Gray supporter complained about another early voting rally Saturday when police had to be called after Fannie's supporters threatened Gray. In other words, voters in Northeast who were directly harmed by Fannie's policies confronted him in person and were outraged at this intrusion into their place of voting. Again, according to WTOP, it was a Fannie supporter that took things to the level of actual violence. Quote, a fight nearly broke out after one of Fannie's critics, Robert Branham, claimed he was hit by a Fannie supporter. In other words, not only did Fannie supporters show up at a place where they were most unwelcome, they resorted to violence and nearly incited a riot. Seems to me, Mayor Fannie is good at inciting trouble in this town. Just when you thought it was bad enough that D.C. mayoral candidate Vincent Gray had to summon police to keep Mayor Fannie's men from beating up his supporters at polling places, a new scandal has erupted. TV7 News is now reporting that someone complained to them about not receiving a job promised to them by Mayor Fannie's campaign office for $100 a day after he rode to an early polling place and voted for Fannie, as an alleged Fannie campaign staffer had asked. At least two separate people have now reported being offered jobs in return for their votes by the Fannie campaign. In other words, good old-fashioned vote buying. Interestingly, Fannie is too cheap to deliver even on these promises. The jobs were not there when people showed up to collect. Fannie's opponent, Vincent Gray, who is leading nearly all polls by double-digit margins, is calling for an FBI investigation of vote buying by Fannie's campaign.
Despite the denials of the spokesperson for the mayor's campaign, there is evidence that this man went down and registered that day and voted that day. I'm a black dog,
man! Fannie always was a backdoor man when it came to awarding city contracts. Now it seems he also prefers to win elections by the back door as well. Are D.C. ballot boxes going to be pre-stuffed with Fannie votes? Seems to me it's the only way he and School Chancellor Ree can ever stay in office.
The Great Recession has struck a severe blow to the tough-on-crime agenda of imposing longer sentences on criminals and building more prisons. Even in conservative states like Texas, Alabama, and Georgia, fiscal reality has set in as state governments have adopted cheaper and more humane alternatives to harsh prison sentences. The Texas prison population increased tenfold from 1972 to 2008, and in 2007, the state decided to end a major prison expansion project in favor of a less expensive plan to increase investment in drug and alcohol treatment services. For the first time in decades, the prison population in the Lone Star State has started to decline. Kansas has followed suit by increasing drug treatment programs for parolees as part of an effort to prevent ex-offenders from committing new drug-related crimes. According to The Nation magazine, 10 states have now embraced a justice reinvestment strategy, which combines reductions in prison spending while diverting funds to community-based anti-crime initiatives.
On the 5th of September, a protest by people affected by BP's oil spill in the Gulf was seriously hampered by interference from both the National Park Service and from Facebook. Thousands have been due to come into D.C. for spill into Washington, but the National Park Service denied all camping permits, and then Facebook systematically blocked pages used by the organizers.
However, he can't access his page either now on Facebook. So
that's why I don't use Facebook. They censor and they give stuff to the cops.
Thank you. That's probably true. So, but we need to make that public. We need to make that known that Facebook has stopped, or at least slowed, our access to other people, to getting information out to people. You need to know that. That's another source of corporate power stopping the people's freedoms.
Closer.
I'm going to turn it back over to Sherry.
When the oil was gushing in the Gulf and the nation's attention was on it on a daily basis, a lot of people were planning on coming to Washington. We were planning on camping here on the Mall. It's a wide open, huge, grassy area where thousands, if not tens of thousands of people could come. They could bring their children. They could bring their food. They could bring coolers. They could hang out. Kind of in a festive spirit while dealing with a horrible, disastrous tragedy. Then when we were denied permission to camp, and yesterday I found out that they don't give anyone a permit to camp on the Mall anymore, it turned out you have to book a room in Washington. Well, there's a lot of people in the Gulf that are unemployed. There's a lot of people that are sick down here.
How are they supposed to go to the Mayflower?
Yes, as an alternative to fossil fuels. The whole sound system you hear in the background is running on these here solar panels. Just these two little solar panels is all it takes.
Hurricane Creek belongs to the people of the United States. It's not a waste conduit for the fat cats in the coal mines that would dump this crap down my stream. Just like the Gulf of Mexico belongs to the people of the United States of America, everybody in America has a right to go down and catch a fish out of the Gulf and eat that fish and not have to worry about what toxins are in the flesh of that fish. Those rights have been stolen from us, folks. They've been stolen from us by a bunch of fat cats from across the water who came over here and condemned our way of life. They not only condemned our Gulf of Mexico, but they condemned our way of life. This is not just an environmental issue. It's a social issue. When one group of people can come across the waters and condemn another whole race of people's way of life for profit, that should be considered a crime. Someone needs to be held accountable. We spent a lot of time putting up this little thing here to make some shade out of it, but I'm afraid just like Thad Allen's truth, the shade just doesn't exist today. There's a lot of shade that's been fed to the American people. You have not been told the truth from day one, I promise you. I went down there right shortly after this mess started, and with the help of a group called South Wings. If you've never heard of them, look them up. Conservation Through Aviation. They're absolutely the angels in the sky that allowed me to get in an airplane and go out there and bring back the truth. In May, I flew out over it. Because of a thunderstorm, we couldn't get to ground zero. I couldn't actually see the source of the BP slick. But at 20 miles from the rig, the Gulf of Mexico, in every direction as far as I could see, was covered with a red, heavy crude oil. I told myself then that it looked like the Gulf was bleeding. That phrase got coined in a video that I later produced. It went viral. And Americans, Germans, Russians, people in Saudi Arabia all responded. That message went around the world because the for-profit medias were sitting on their butts taking orders from BP's Thad Allen. The truth was not told. The second flight when I went out was the first time that I'd encountered one of the in-situ burns. We got all the way out to the source this time. We flew around and there was a cloud of smoke that came up off the water. It went 4,500 feet in the air and stretched out damn near all the way to the Florida coast. It was incredible what I saw. When I came back and made the next video, I made the statement that I felt like for the first time in my life, it was hopeless. There was no way to stop what was happening to the Gulf of Mexico. All the promises from BP's Thad Allen and all the failures that called themselves restoration experts that came in and said we could keep it out of our marshes, they were lying to us, folks. You can't stop something that big. It never should have been drilled in the first place if they couldn't control it.
Yeah.
Nowhere in the world should anybody punch a hole into the grandmother if you're not prepared to suffer the consequences for what you've done.
Oh!
We breached something down there that nobody's ever dealt with. The Russians came in and said, you people are crazy for doing this. You shouldn't be down there. We've actually penetrated something that I don't think anybody had any conscious thought of what the possibilities were, except those that were making profit off of our losses.
There's a hole in the earth that you spew in a soul. Says you want all my riches, well, I no longer hold. You can drown in my backpack, love. Drown in my backpack, love. And when you're powering money, come a tumbling down. Cling to your beaches, red, sticky, and brown. Drown in my backpack, love. You can drown in my backpack, but I tried to tell you, but you're not listening. And now your veins torn open wide.
On the one hand, the combination of the drilling moratorium and contaminated seafood mean there are very few jobs for anybody in the Gulf of Mexico thanks to contamination left over from BP's Macondo spill. On the other hand, there's about 18,000 abandoned oil wells in shallow water all over the Gulf of Mexico just waiting for a ship's anchor to drag on them in a hurricane and open them up and cause another mammoth spill. These wells are capped only with metal caps. They've never been bottom killed, top killed, or anything else. If we were to send all of the oil rigs that are available in the Gulf of Mexico to top kill these wells with concrete and mud, there'd be work for every boat and every drilling crew for years to come, after which alternative energy development could provide another set of jobs for the same people.
Is your SUV running low on gas? Has your wallet been running on fumes lately? Well, this is Behind Pollution, offering blowout prices on regular, plus, and premium at every BP Behind Pollution gas station, where you can get a gusher of savings filling up that Ford Excursion or that Hummer. And never mind our blown-out oil well at Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico. Never mind all those oiled pelicans. And never mind this burning hot summer of global warming. Never mind the voices that tell you to boycott BP for the horrific things Behind Pollution has done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just keep filling up that SUV. Just keep enjoying that gusher of savings the blowout prices at BP gas stations are bringing you. After all, you never liked seafood much anyway.
Well, DNA is natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life, each one dependent on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes, and when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things, and now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows that grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
A massive recall of eggs linked to salmonella contamination began on August 13th after the Centers for Disease Control announced the eggs were connected to more than 1,300 reported cases of salmonella poisoning. Overall, a half billion eggs were recalled nationwide. The Food and Drug Administration has opened a criminal investigation with the Justice Department as the federal agency looks into the cause of the outbreak. FDA inspectors who visited Wright County Egg Company in Iowa, one of the egg farms at the center of the salmonella outbreak, reported finding rodents, flies, maggots, and chicken manure piled as high as 8 feet tall. Chickens can contract salmonella bacteria from rodent droppings, which pass to the bird's ovaries and then inside the egg. Ironically, new, stricter FDA regulations on preventing salmonella contamination at large egg farms had gone into effect in July. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Patty Lovera, assistant director of the group Food and Water Watch. She discusses the egg recall in the context of large-scale factory farming and the danger to consumers without adequate food safety inspections and enforcement.
Eggs have salmonella in them because the chickens had salmonella in their system. And then the question is, well, how did the chickens, you know, get exposed to salmonella and have it in their systems? And so there are several different ways it can happen. So there's a lot of focus for large operations raising birds to keep out mice and rats because rodents could bring in salmonella, and if their feces is in there, you could get salmonella that way. They're worried about wild birds, but they're also worried about what the chickens are eating. And so the investigation, I believe, is also going on at the company that both these firms that recalled eggs were buying feed, evidently, from the same company. So they're worried about the feed coming out of that operation as well. So there's different angles they have to run down. But, you know, the focus of preventing salmonella, a lot of it is on sanitation. It's keeping these facilities kind of contained and trying to keep out these sources of salmonella. But we also want to hear more, and I hope that we do hear more, about how big these operations were and what kind of conditions, you know, the chickens are being raised in, what kind of stress they're under, and what role that plays. Because there's a lot of controversy about putting so many animals in one facility and if that makes them more susceptible to diseases like salmonella.
You often hear that the Food and Drug Administration and other agencies of the government don't have enough inspectors to really ensure in a very foolproof way the safety of our food here in this country. What's the system in place for egg production? I read that there recently was some new regulations put in place at the federal level to do more intense inspection of eggs. I think that was back in July.
Right, and that's one. I mean, there's always an issue of resources, and the FDA is in charge of eggs that are in the shell, like that are involved in this recall. They're in charge of produce, you know, vegetables and fruit. They're in charge of fish and processed food. So they have a lot of the food supply, and they don't have a lot of inspectors to go out, and they don't get to plants very often, and that's been a historic problem we've had to deal with. When it comes to eggs, they also didn't have rules for a long time. It took over a decade, actually, for the FDA to put out rules on what big companies should do to prevent salmonella in eggs. They just went into effect in July, so we haven't really even seen them, you know, use them and get them up and running and go out and inspect and see if they're being followed before we had this dramatic example of, you know, what can go wrong.
Patty, I read that your group, Food and Water Watch, has stated that currently most eggs produced in the United States are from just five states, and some of these very giant egg production houses, factory farms, and that your group would be in favor of decentralizing, that it should be not just five states or a handful of these big chicken egg factories, but in fact smaller farms that presumably could have a higher quality control. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is across our food system at this point, but eggs are actually a very good example of how really concentrated everything has gotten. You know, it's not like the picture on the package anymore where we've got these very small farms with just a handful of chickens and maybe a couple cows. I mean, we've really specialized and concentrated this food production. So we have five states that produce half the eggs in the country. you know, 12 companies. There are 12 companies that produce eggs that have more than 5 million chickens laying eggs for them. So most eggs that people buy are coming from, you know, what we would call a factory farm, a very large operation that's got, you know, 75,000, 100,000 chickens. So this is not the picture on the package, and it's a different type of production, and we think that, you know, the regulations have not kept up with the risks that come with this type of facility. So there's lots of folks that are interested in raising chickens a different way. You know, we need to help them figure out where and how to do that and reconnect, you know, consumers and smaller producers and have the processing and the links you need to restore kind of local production like that. If for no other reason than they're smaller operations, and if something does go wrong, you're not going to have 500 million eggs involved. It's going to be smaller numbers. We think there's also a lot of differences in the type of eggs you get out of that system.
How would you gauge the influence of the big agriculture companies on our regulatory system here to keep our food safe? Obviously, these guys got a lot of money, and they want to maximize their profit. But are they pretty successful at diluting regulations?
Sadly, across the board, yeah, they are. And that goes from, you know, what are the standards for, you know, environmental permits for facilities like this to what are the labels that are on our food. I mean, we're always kind of running up against big agricultural interests whenever you're talking about something like this. And eggs, you know, it took 10 years for there to be an FDA standard on salmonella in eggs because the industry didn't want to be regulated. They kept saying, let us do a voluntary program. Let us do this instead. We don't need a regulation. Why don't we just get some guidance? You know, I mean, there's all these suggestions they have instead because they really don't want to be regulated. And that goes across the board.
That was Patty Lovera, Assistant Director of the group Food and Water Watch. Contact the group at area code 202-683-2500 or visit their website at foodandwaterwatch.org.
On the 4th of September, protesters showed up here at 1630 B19th Street, back at the alley where Michael Pace, head of government relations for Goldman Sachs, lives. Goldman Sachs, through its investments in Fortress, has been propping up Huntington Life Sciences, a contract animal tester.
Shareholder in Fortress, the life support system of Huntington Life Sciences. Huntington Life Sciences is a contract animal testing facility that murders 500 animals each and every day of the week. They've been exposed in 7 separate undercover investigations for punching 4-month-old beagle puppies in the face, dissecting live primates, and mutilating rabbits to the highest bidder. And Michael Pace, you are directly responsible for this. Because, see, you know exactly what you need to do, Michael. You need to end your and sell all your shares with Fortress, the life support system of Huntington Life Sciences. We're not going away. This 500 animals died today!
Michael Pace is to blame!
500 animals suffered in pain!
Michael Pace is to blame!
Michael Pace for the cat and for the mouse!
We are here outside your house!
Michael Pace for the beagle, for the mouse!
We are here outside your house!
For the rabbit, for the mouse!
We are here outside your house!
For the your money!
Your fault!
Your greed!
Your fault!
Your job!
Your fault!
Your company!
Your fault!
Your 20 minutes!
No cops!
Been 20 minutes!
No cops!
Michael Pace, it's been 20 minutes!
No cops!
Oh, Lord, yes, it's been 20.
Finally, after about half an hour of protesters having a total free hand, two cops arrived, only to tell agitated neighbors that protesters had every legal right to be there.
We've got some neighbors supporting us, another neighbor agitated, trying to get the cops to do something about the protest when the law and the First Amendment say that the police can only stand and watch.
He's actually in the corner there.
Polluting the land, polluting the water.
Dropping it off the animal's
floor. Oh, Lord, yes.
Polluting the water.
Time of the protest. Word came out that Goldman Sachs had just dumped 2/3 of their shares in Fortress, 1/3 left to go. Whether investors follow suit, Fortress will go bankrupt, and after them, Huntington Life Sciences as well. In
Where the money came from.
For the reason Huntington Life Sciences is still in existence today. So Michael Pace, you can go in on Monday. Go tell Roy Blankfein that they need to sell all their shares with Huntington Life Sciences. We're not going away. We're not backing down. This is our first time here, and it definitely will not be our last unless you several times of Huntington Life Sciences and sell all your shares with Fortress. So Michael Pace, until next time, until all our three will be back, will be back.
Because in D.C. there's... Huntington Life Sciences is a contract animal testing laboratory where investigators have caught so-called researchers punching beagle puppies in the face and cutting up live monkeys without anesthetic. They would have gone bankrupt a year ago if another company called Fortress hadn't made $100 million in loans to them. On the 7th of September, the siege of Fortress continued with Goldman Sachs and Nomura, two major stockholders in Fortress, receiving visits at the office from protesters. Goldman Sachs is buckling. They've dumped two-thirds of their stock in Fortress, but they still hold one-third more, and the protests don't stop until they dump everything. In addition, Bayer and Sanofi of Venice, two notorious customers of puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences, also received protests at their offices.
We started off actually at Goldman Sachs, also demanding that they drop all the remaining one-third of shares.
And they've dumped two-thirds already.
It was funny because when we arrived, security came out with these velvet ropes and put them out in front of the building, and they had like five security guards out there, really came out to make sure that we don't get into the office area. We only stayed there for about 20-25 minutes and then moved on to Nomura, where activists did enter the lobby and with a air horn. That was at Nomura.
At Nomura.
And then we showed up at the AstraZeneca and Bayer office, and actually were able to penetrate the doors. We hung back for until an employee was going in, and then we went in after them.
Nice.
And we were able to give a speak out and sound the air horn as well.
Nice.
That was heard throughout the building.
These protests work. It takes time, but eventually the big pharmaceutical companies always get it up to dump Huntington Life Sciences like Pfizer, the maker of Viagra, did. And financial companies tend to divest much more quickly. Only a couple months into the campaign, Goldman Sachs has already dumped two-thirds of their shares in Fortress and will no doubt soon find themselves dumping the rest. As Fortress finds themselves facing the investors' equivalent of a run on the bank, they will have no choice but to dump Huntington Life Sciences themselves, and when that happens, puppy killing, monkey torturing Huntington Life Sciences will close their doors forever. Hold your head up high, raise your-